Right, we're up to Perkei Aleph, Pasuk Zayin, and Yechezkel. Remember that the previous story that we had touched upon was the Talmud says, Masechah Shabbos, as an anomaly in the whole Bible, where God promised that the people who had the tuff on their foreheads, right, that they would be saved from the onslaught of Jerusalem, but they weren't. They were taken down with all of the other people. So it's only one exception. Things were so bad then that there was like tohu vavohu. It was like Hester Ponim. God's face was hidden and everyone went down. If you recall, I think I told you last time, the opening drash and the Zohar is where all the letters of the alphabet ask that the Torah starts with them. So Bez got it, but they started with tough and going down, and each letter said, start the Torah with me. I'm the first letter in the word Torah. Shalom, Rachamim, Kedusha. And each time God says, yeah, but you're also the first word in Russia, Klala, Shekir. So what was the first one that God responded? He goes, well, you think I should start the Torah with you because you start the word Torah? You're also the letter Tav, which is what Yechezkel put on everyone's forehead that should have made them survive, and they didn't. So I'm angry with the letter Tav. I don't want the Torah to start with the letter Tav. As if though these people didn't survive against the will of God, so to say. But things got so bad that they just were swept up in the destruction. So that's where we are.
Shlomo Halbach said that the Torah begins with an Aleph, but it's hidden.
Uh-huh.
As any movement that starts with very small people, like the Soviet Jewry movement, with a small bunch of people.
Well, that's why Vayikra is a little Aleph. That's all right. Okay. But sounds right. Sounds Kopachian. So Pasuk Zayin. L'chein Komar Hashem Elokim. Chalaleichem Asher Samtem Besocha Hema Habasar Behi Asir Veschem Hotzi Misocha. Right. Wow. He says, the people who remain in Yerushalayim are like the meat that'll go into a cauldron. It's very, very terrible. Listen, we have to understand this in light of Sefer Yirmiyahu. You see, Yirmiyahu had been calling during this time for a peaceful resolution with the Babylonians. The Babylonian intention was clear. They were coming down to destroy. They had destroyed other nations. They're coming down to destroy Jerusalem. And there was the basic movement in Jerusalem was to stand up to them. Was to try to get to train an army in order to fight the Babylonians. And Yirmiyahu's message to these people in Jerusalem was that you're making things worse. Just lay down your arms, give in. This was not a popular message at the time. We know this, we've been through this before. It was as popular then as it would be today to tell the Knesset, let the Iranians take over. We're facing a much worse threat if we stand up to them. Right? Let them take over the Knesset. They'll be kindly disposed to us as long as they're ruling, right? So when the difference is that today we don't have prophets. At that time we had a prophet. But to the average Israelite, Yirmiyahu was not a prophet. Because the average Israelite did not heed him.
Right? But they thought he was a false prophet.
They accused him of being a false prophet, and he was so accused by many a real false prophet. You get it? A real false prophet. Yirmiyahu is not a real false prophet. He's a real prophet. So it's hard to know when you're there. The only reason, how do we know that Yirmiyahu was the real prophet? Because we have his book survived, and then right, and what he said happened. What happened did happen. Anyway, Yechezkel is also saying the same. Jews who remain in the city and put up a fight will be meat for a cauldron. It's a very harsh way of saying what's going to happen. Cherev yireisem v'cherev avi aleichem nu mashem alukim. You feared the sword will come to you. Have you heard of this pasuk? Megoras Russia hi tavosa. What a Russia fears most will come to him. Because it's his evil makes that thing come to him. Does it sound right? The Rashi brings down that pasuk as a message of an early story in the Torah. Megorat Rasha hi tavota. Megorat Rasha hi tavota. Where the Rasha fears comes to him. He's says this in the middle of the Migdal Bavel story. They acted, they make this big tower, pen the foots, lest we be scattered. And that's exactly what happened to him. Their behavior made it more scattering. Right? Megoras Rosh Hashanah Tavasa. You feared this? This is exactly what's going to come to you because of your behavior. Right? I'm going to remove you from the land. I'm going to put you in the hands of strangers. And I will make judgments against you. This is, by the way, in this week's Parsha. This is in this week's Haftorah. Yeshayahu tells the people, if you don't listen to God's command in Hebrew, in simple Hebrew, you will have to listen to the command of the enemy in a language you don't understand. And here, they'll bark out commands to you in a language you don't understand. And then beat you for not doing what they say. Right? So how about, wouldn't it be easier for you to listen to the simple commands of God in a language you do understand, Hebrew? Right? Bacherev tipolu al gvul Yisrael asher yivaseh. You will fall by the sword on the boundary of Israel, I will judge you. Vidatem ki ani Hashem. At that point, you'll know. Okay? Alright? Now, we have to, Pasuk Yud Aleph, something very strange is going to happen in Yechezkel. These are all visions of the fall of Yerushalayim. Right? Try to think what advice I can give someone about a failing business from this chapter. Right? You getting it yet? No one? Okay. Keep going. We're talking in the beginning, Elise, about deriving things you should do by opening up a Bible. And,
okay. Do you want to repeat
just,
that?
And just reading, and just reading the beginning of the chapter and determining, or some point of the chapter that comes on the page to determine what should be done. So someone came to me with a question about a failed business of how he should build it up, whether he should just cut his losses. So this is the chapter that came up when he was asking about it. Right, so there's something in this chapter that might shed light on what he should do. So pasuk yudalef, he lo tihi alochem l'sir, v'atem tihi b'socho l'basar, el gvul Yisrael l'shvot eschem. Right, the city. Now here it says the city will not be your cauldron. He lo tihi alochem l'sir. He just said that the city will be the cauldron. Right, and then he says v'atem tihi b'socho l'basar. Right. The city shall not be your cauldron. He lo tihi alochem l'sir, va'atem tihiyu b'socho l'basar. Carol, can you read the English of verse 11? The city shall not be your. You have it? Chapter.
Oh, the city will not be a pot for you, but you will be like meat within it.
Okay, but how? So what? What does that mean?
How could it be meat?
How do you meet in something that's not a cauldron? His whole point was the city. If you remain in the city will be destructive. You have to give up to the Babylonians. Give yourselves up. Walk out to them and put your hands up in the air and say, "Do to us what you will, but don't remain in the city fighting for it."
Oh, okay. So that's right? The business.
So the city.
Don't remain in the business.
Okay. The city is your cauldron. But here, and listen to my English translation, which is very different, and it's based on Rashi. It says, the city shall not be your cauldron, neither shall you be the meat in the midst of it.
That makes sense. Right?
In other words, he expresses the low on the beginning of the Pasuk, as well as the end of the Pasuk. I'm telling you that the city will not be a cauldron, and you will not be meat in it. Right? If you go out to give yourselves up.
But if you stay, you will be like it said before.
And you will know that God of Israel, who predicted these things, you will know that you act in accordance with what he says you should do, it'll be good for you. If you don't, it won't. If you want to wait for these things to happen, wait. Or just do as you're told. Right? Vayihi kihinovi, when I gave this prophecy, Uplatyahu ben Benaya Mace.
He died?
right? A man named Platyahu ben Benayah died. Okay, when I prophesied these things, a man with this name passed away. Okay? So let's try to figure out who Platyahu ben Benayah is. Okay. So let's just read a few more psukim before we ask him. And I fell on my face and I cried out, "Va'omar, Aha Adonai Elohim, Kala Ata Oseh Esheris Yisrael." It's happening now, right? Everybody is falling away, and we haven't even gotten to the stage of what you said was going to happen. Why are people dying so soon?
They're falling away in Babylonian or in Israel?
In Jerusalem. Now, here's the thing. Yechezkel's entire book was said by him while he was in Babylonia.
Yes.
He is, however, foretelling what is happening in Jerusalem.
Was Jeremiah in Jerusalem at that time? Jeremiah was in Jerusalem.
Yes. According to the Radak, a very important commentary, Jeremiah was Yechezkel's father. Mm-hmm. So this would be just in a short period, because he was taken out of Jerusalem in 597. And the destruction is 586. So these prophecies are somewhere in those 11 years in between. I will tell you this. The name Platya ben Benayah is never found anywhere else but here. And it makes some of the commentaries you find in the Das Mikra say that it's actually a symbolic name. What name do you have from Palat? Palat means Polit, means a survivor. Usually like a lone survivor. Right? Platas. You ever have Sheris HaPlata? Right, have you heard of that?
So he's a survivor and he dies.
So it says, Pleitas Hashem and Ben Hashem. Even the survivors, those are the people with the tufts on their heads that's supposed to survive all of this. Right? So it seems that it's a symbol, as we'll see later in the Perek. It might appear that way. Okay. Pasuk Yudalit. Be'idvar Hashem Elay Lemor. Read Yudalit and Tesfah, please. Be'idvar
Hashem Elay Lemor. Ben Adam, Achacha Achacha, Anshei Gvulatacha, V'chal Beit Yisrael Kulo, Asher Amru Lahem, Yoshvei Yerushalayim, Rachaku Me'al Hashem Lanu, Lanu Hinitna Ha'aretz L'morasha.
Okay, so you see, he's expressing what Yirmiyahu says explicitly, is that go to the people of who went into Golus with you, and look at what they're saying in Yerushalayim. They're saying, let's remove ourselves from God. The land has been given to us as an inheritance. It will remain with us. We don't have to listen to these foolish prophets, Tzfanya, Bechulda, and Yirmiyahu, and the like. There's no need for this. We're doing fine. Right? Okay. So this is what Ezekiel is saying. He hears prophetically, because he's not there. Yirmiyahu is there. He's in Golan. Lochein emor ko amar Hashem Elokim. This is a benchmark pasuk. This is one of the most important pasukim in Sefer Yechezkel. Why am I saying this?
It's
a very famous concept. Because you know that when the temple stands, the temple is the central focus of all Jews. If you live in Be'er Sheva to Haifa, Your religious focus is the Beis HaMikdash, is the temple. Yechezkel says, Jews, you have to start preparing yourself for a situation where you no longer have that focus. It's a whole different set of circumstances. No more animal sacrifice, no more incense, no more pilgrimage. There's a whole different set of circumstances that will replace the temple. And that is what this pasuk calls the Mikdash Me'at. Gemara Megillah Daf Chav Tes says, what is the Mikdash Ma'at?
Shul,
the Beis Knesses. There will be a replacement for the time being. When you don't have a temple, Jewish communal life does not have to end. You can have your own Mikdash Ma'at. Now, the Reform movement, I believe, misread this pasuk to call a shul
a temple.
A temple. But Dafka, we try to refrain from referring. I know there's some Temple Bethel, I think, in Borough Park. There's some shuls that had the name Temple, probably because they were huge edifices.
And my mother-in-law always used to call, are you going to Temple?
Right, so why were secular Jews referring to a shul as Temple? if this was not just done because of a fine word, it was done with intent. It was German Jews in the 1840s, 1850s, they specifically wanted to refer to their place as temple, so that Jews should not any longer look to hope to rebuild that old structure that no longer. I mean, certainly by 1840, the concept of animal sacrifice, which would kill us in the eyes of animal rights and PETA and stuff like that today, but the vast majority of the animal sacrifice that would go on in such a temple is eaten by the people who bring it. I mean, it's no more barbaric than a barbecue, for goodness sakes. But this is why it's called shlomim, because it brings shalom, it brings people together, it brings family members. I mean, if you have a side of beef and you only have 2 days to eat it, you'd be sure that you're going to bring all your cousins and 100 people to Jerusalem together, and it's a nice thing to do on occasion. It brings the family together. Right? We have an upsharing in the family, maybe we'll see a couple of cousins. But here, on a regular basis, you bring shalom, and it brings shalom to people. So this we've lost this. We don't even miss it, because we don't know it. But so the German Jews made a conscious decision that we have our own temple here in Berlin. Berlin is a temple, right? We have our own temple in Stuttgart. We have our own.
I had a picture just this weekend of the rebuilt temple in the synagogue in Berlin.
Right, they made them huge edifices, usually with large domes, and we have one here. But they made really these huge, huge buildings. And this was meant to be the Mikdash Ma'at, but it was not meant to replace our longing for the pilgrimage to Jerusalem, right? Okay? So this is a very famous pasuk of Mikdash Ma'at, okay? So the Beis HaKnesses and the Beis HaMedrash, there are other places that in the meantime can be a central focus for the Jew. I remember in my first shul on 84th Street, there were some men that their whole life revolved around the shul. They would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and start getting ready, and they would meet early for Lachaim, they'd open up early for some people who wanted to learn. And I remember Dr. Fisher and then Mr. Tannenbaum and Mr. Horowitz. These guys were like, they were already in their late 80s, and then the shul was their whole life.
We had some
Right?
Like that in the Bronx. Yeah,
that's right. It was everything they did from morning to when they went to sleep. Practically everything they did revolved around their shul. Right? Okay, so Lachem, therefore, so other people know, Emor ko amar Hashem Elokim, v'kibatzti eschem min ha'amim v'asavti eschem min ha'aratzos asher nefotzosem v'hem v'nasati lachem esad mas Yisrael. Let it be known, heed my words, those who listen to me will return, their grandchildren will return. Those who put up a fight, they won't have grandchildren. They'll all be taken away. If you want this land back, what was Yirmiyahu's plan? Remember what he did to show the people that they're coming back? Tzivi lach tzionim, set up markers, and that's in chapter 31, chapter 32. He bought land. He bought land ahead. He said, and people are saying, why are you buying land? You're driving down real estate prices by telling us we're all going to lose the land, and then you buy land yourself? What for? So Hashem tells him, Yirmiyahu complained about this himself. And he said, because I'm buying it for my grandchildren. I want them to have the deed. Okay? So this is the pasuk that says that you will return. And when you return, you will remove all these shkutz, shikutzim, and toevos. Now, Yechezkel himself referred to these toevos. If you look back at chapter 8, and you remember abominations of Mikdash, remember the women weaving the garments for Tammuz and the Tavnis al-Hakir? Yechezkel went up and had a vision of the Beis Mikdash and saw writing and images on the walls. Like your picture of an Egyptian temple, don't you? An Assyrian temple, don't you have pictures on the wall all over depicting their battles and depicting the people they're ruling over? I'm sure you have pictures in here of all this, right? I think we showed them last week. So these Assyrian pictures here, they're in here. They have their pictures in their temples, and Yechezkel has a vision of pictures on our temple as well, drawings on the wall. This is very, very much against our Masorah. I must confess that there are a few pictures that we have in the Mikdash. One is the lions on the parochas, right? Hence, some shuls allow have lions at the top of the aron. We don't have it here, if you notice. But very often you have two lions on the sides of the Ten Commandments, right? We should keep the Ten Commandments, not lions. So we'll have to, we have to uphold them. Anyway, there were lions, and of course the cherubs, the two cherubim in the Holy of Holies, had the face of children. But other than that, we didn't have any drawings or any pictures. And Yechezkel refers to all those toevos, all those abominations, and now he's saying, you will remove those. Beautiful psukim. I'll give them a new heart. It means a heart transplant. I'll give them a new heart in their midst. Okay. If you remember the song, Yeshavonim im lev shel lev adam, Yeshanoshim im lev shel even, Yeshavonim im lev adam. Hakotel, you know? It's a song about the kotel. Listen to the words. Yesh Av anashim im lev shel even, yesh avonim im lev adam. The stones of the kotel have a human heart, and some people have a stone heart.
Does the kotel be something like, you know, when Christians talk about the brit chadasha, like the ruach chadasha? Do they take it to mean anything?
Yeah, probably. I could picture them doing something. I don't know classical sources that mention this. I'll give you a new spirit, right? And I'll remove the heart of stone, and I will give you a heart of flesh. Okay. Laman b'chuko sayilechu, so that you can walk in my statutes. Ves'mishpatai yishmeru v'asu osam. V'ayuli la'am v'niye yelam le'elohim. You'll be a nation to me, I'll be a God to you. You just have to remove your stubbornness. Nothing can be done when you have a lave of Evan. Right? Because no prophet can convince you of what's true. Right? If someone wants to be blind, they'll remain blind. But if you have what's a lev? You ever hear Rabbi Akiva? Have you heard the story about his tshuva? How Rabbi Akiva came to do tshuva? He was 40 years old, and he was walking by a brook.
Oh, yes.
And he saw the water cascading.
The water into the stone, making a tiny little hole. So if water can make a hole in a rock...
Which is hard.
How much affects my heart,
which is... But if his heart is stone, then you won't feel it. But I have my heart. Lev basar. So that's what this is talking about. Meaning, what is a lev basar as opposed to lev evan? Lev basar is an open heart, open mind. Obviously, we can't keep our mind too open. The brains will fall out. But you have to, you know, there has to be some. So that's what he's talking about. So he says, you know, if you have such a heart, then you'll be able to walk in my statutes. You know, then when you go to a madrigal, you say b'chol levavcha, fill with your whole heart with that. There's no room for anything else. But no room for shtus. There's only room for spirit. Okay. The Elev Shikutzehem. Would you read
the Elev Shikutzehem v'Torabotehem Libam Holech Darkam Barosham Natati Nam Hashem Elokim.
Okay, so we have to Sur Meirov Asay Tov. You know, you have to get rid of what's in your heart now. Now, in some cases, the person is so taken up by this behavior that the brain's ability to make that decision is impaired. Do you know what I'm saying? Like some things that physiologically affects the brain's ability to make this decision. A drunk, it's not just a question of I need the liquor. The liquor is so important to me, and it's more important to me than my wife, my family, my job, my house. I'll sleep in the park, but as long as I get my hands on some liquor. Sleep in the cold and sleep on the train, as long as I get the next bottle of wine. What makes it more so that the person makes such a bad decision, right, is that the liquor itself is impairing him from looking, okay, I have a wife who will still take me back, I have a family who loves me, and I have a bottle of wine. No, let me get it. There's something in the brain that doesn't let that decision be made properly. Right? We do things so sweet. You wonder what could possibly make a person do this, right? Remember the guy who walks into a doctor's nutritionist's office, and there's a carrot sticking out of his ear, a cucumber in his nose, and a celery stalk sticking out of the other ear. So he goes, doc, what's wrong with me? And he goes, oh my goodness, I've seen this before. You're not eating properly.
That's right.
So the In other words, they you know, it looks so outrageously ridiculous, but the point is that, you know, that we have to train ourselves from our earliest years to make right decisions. You know, a doctor can tell me, you know, your cholesterol is sky high. You got to stay away from that saturated fat. But I'm, you know, and sometimes I can't help it. I have such a desire for this Häagen-Dazs ice cream. I just have to have some. You know, I'll steal away a little bit. But you see, my religious persuasion says that if I just have a bologna sandwich, that I wouldn't do that because I'm fleischig. Uh-huh. Right. So the religious sensitivity of the particular upbringing, particular person aids that particular decision. I know some people who are told these kind of things, who purposely will just take a nibble of something fleischig so that I can't have those brownies now. You know, they ruin it for themselves, so to say. You know, the only that, because that persuasion is more powerful.
In celebration of Carol's birthday yesterday, we had dinner with my son and his wife and Carol's sister Adana, and we all had the
ribs,
the lamb, which is very soft and good. Came home, I was so a bit hungry. I did reach for the ice cream. Uh-huh. I reached for the pomegranate.
Okay, see, you go.
That's the difference.
There you go. It's all protection. Okay, so he says that now that if you can remove yourself from these abominations and train yourself to make the right decisions, it's not easy when you're used to other behavior. It's like starting a business after a bankruptcy, right? You getting my hint now?
Yeah, that's what you should do. Yeah.
Yeah, but what was it about this chapter that made him move in that direction?
Why would
looking at this chapter determine that he should start all over? No one's getting it yet?
I did. I had it.
What chapter is this?
I had it right in the beginning.
But what chapter are we in?
You know.
I think Akiva got it.
What?
No, Perkei Aleph is chapter...
isn't it just accepting that...
Well, that's the content of the chapter. Yes, accept the failure and move and start all over and move on. Yeah. No, but what chapter is this?
Chapter 11.
Thank you.
Oh, chapter 11. Oh, my God.
Okay. All right. Vayisu ha-kruvim es kanfehem... So Yechezkel is, you know, you'll see peppered throughout the book his own picture of remember his mystical Zohar base pictures of the angels, right? Baruch Yivod Hashem Imkomo. That was already part of chapter 1 that we went through. Chapter 10, I said I'm folding my hands and I'm, you know, and this is chapter 11. He makes a reference to this again. Of these angelic figures, the Kruvim, the Ofanim, right? Vayal Kvod Hashem Eyal Tocha Ir Vayamod Al Ha'or Asher Mikedem Lo'ir. You see, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to rest His Shechina in our midst. He wants to have a place, something that is all good, can only be good if it shares the good, it spreads the good. It wants to have as much of a shefa, bracha, a blessing. Is you know, for us to bless God, whether this mouth is gonna actually change the nature of God? No, it's in the recognition on my part that God is the source of all that is good and blessed. So that the Shekhinah, however, will not reside in the midst of a people who are selling others into slavery for being incapable of paying back debt. The Shekhinah will not reside in the midst of people who behave this way. So Hashem says, if you want my Shekhinah in your midst, where no nation could ever come in and conquer you as such. Remember when the Aron was working for them, they took it to battle and it destroyed everything in its wake. But when the Aron, when they're not following God's will, the Aron is just a box of wood and gold, and it's just be taken by anyone. Right? So Ruach Nisa'asni Vatvieni Kasdima El Hagolah Bamareh Baruch Elokim Vayal Me'alayah Mareh Asher Isi. Now remember all of this. Remember the prophecy that began a few chapters ago, where he spoke about seeing Jerusalem. He was taken by. Remember how God took him from the tzitzis, from the tzitzis of his head. So the question is, what's the tzitzis of your head? So some say God grabbed him by his...
The corners of your head.
Others say he grabbed him by his payas. Yeah, he grabbed him by the corners of his head. And he dragged and he carried him to Jerusalem to see what's going on there. Now, most commentaries say that that's just a vision. It means that Hashem opened his eyes and said, look, now, see, you have a video screen of Jerusalem. You're on the camp. So, but some say he was actually taken up to Jerusalem, and that was when he's being brought back. Kastima means back to the Kastim, back to Babylonia. Okay. Vayami Alei Marei Asher Isi. And then, Adkan, until now, this is what I saw in Jerusalem. Vatabera Lagolo is called Yivrei Hashem Asher Rani. So I went to share these visions with the people in the exile. And that's what he does in chapter 12. Ve'idvar Hashem elai lemor, ben adam, b'soch beis hameri ata yoshev, asher einayim lahem liros v'lo ra'u, asnayim lahem lishmo v'lo shameu ki beis merihem. I told you before that this word appears almost exclusively in the book of Yechezkel. The word is meri. Meri means like merit. Meri is a...
Better.
Word meri, chapter 12, verse 1 and 2. Meri means rebellious.
Which is better. Okay.
All right, so he refers to the house of Mary. Okay, so now he is going to relate to a number of symbolic acts. The first 20 psukim of chapter 12. Right, he's going to refer to a number of symbolic acts, and I remind you of a way that we learned, say, for Yechezkel, is that these symbolic acts were not actually acted out. Hashem told him to lie on one side for 390 days, and then turn around and lie on the other side for 40 days. How could this possibly be a worthwhile message for a prophet? These are symbolic acts. In a dream, he dreamed lying this way for so many days, and then he delivered the message. The grandfather of all of these explanations of symbolic acts is actually not in this book, but in Sefer Hosea, where the prophet is told to marry a harlot, to have three children with her, to name them three names, to not be sure if they're even his children. She's maybe so behaving like she always is. And then he's told, well, your God, your wife is Israel, the children are the ill-begotten deeds of the Israelites. And the question is, did he actually do this or not? Rashi says he did it. It's pshat. Ben Ezra says, cholila, cholila, to so diminish the eyes of the people, the prophet, by doing these things. What about Yechezkel's dry bones prophecy? I'm sure you're familiar with that prophecy. What's so problematic with that? He's a Kohen. He's not supposed to be in the field with bones. So what's he doing there? And Hashem tells him to shave off every bit of his hair. That's coming up soon. Every bit of hair from his hair. Eyebrows, eyelashes, everything. And go around to the people. Let them ask you, why are you doing this? And then give them a message. How is that going to make them think that he's anything but strange?
He's from the family of banished Kohanim, if you remember. It's his father. That,
yeah.
So.
But I'm not so sure of that, Red Dot, because Yechezkel shows a very, very clear inner knowledge of how the kuna works. Yo doesn't, but Yechezkel does. So that would seem that they're, I don't know. It seems to be, even within Chazal, it seems to be a question of whether they're related or not. I'm going to have to, I'm sorry, stop.